Hello, I'm Yolanda Brown and welcome to LPO Offstage. This is the podcast where we talk all things classical music with the London Philharmonic Orchestra. Sometimes on LPO Offstage, we explore a particular piece in detail, and that's what we'll be doing today with Gustav Holst's The Planets. It's one of those pieces you'll recognise even if you don't know its name, and any LPO Offstage superfans out there might remember that we did a deep dive into The Planets back in episode 75. So many episodes now. Well, we're revisiting it today because Faber has just published a brand new facsimile edition of the work. Now, I'm backstage at the rehearsal venue for the LPO, Henry Wood Hall, and it all feels very musical. We've got sheet music around us, and it really, really feels great. I'm joined by the LPO's principal conductor, Ed Gardner, principal flute, Juliet Borza, and composer, Colin Matthews. Welcome back, Ed and Juliet, and welcome to the podcast. Colin, it's great to have you all.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to ask you a non-musical stroke musical question to start with. If you could visit one of the seven planets that Holst wrote for, and this might be informed by his musicality, but also maybe what you know about the actual planet, what planet would you pick? Colin?
I wouldn't actually want to go to any of them. They're so in...
You're on one.
They're so in, they're so inhospitable, and I certainly wouldn't visit Venus. Yeah. I think I'd like a closer look at Saturn.
Yeah, nice. Okay, I'm going to delve into that in a moment. Juliet?
I think I'd have to just hope that I can go to Mars and get some water. I mean...
I like that. And Ed?
It's between two for me, actually. It's like Colin, Saturn. I think there's something incredibly soulful about that, that deep, wise sound he creates in that movement. And the other is Mercury. Okay. Which is so flighty and brilliant. I mean, I think it's one of the greatest things he wrote. Maybe the shortest of the suite?
It is the shortest, yeah. Yes.
But just it's pure poetry. And actually, in this edition, it's so beautifully written. That's the thing I got most out of looking at the facsimile.
I've so many questions that have just boiled into my head, but I just want to just finish that thought. Colin, Saturn, musically then, what would drag you there?
Well, it's a most characteristic of Holst, I think, of almost any of the movements. It's got this solemn processional and this sudden wild outburst in the middle. And it's remarkable. It's not like any of the other movements, really, but it's very characteristic of the composer.
Very nice. And Mars for you, Juliet?
Well, the drama of the piece probably the most dramatic, but at the same time, I have to say it's not my favourite musically to play.
So would your answer be different if I asked you musically?
Yes.
What would it be?
It would be a toss-up between Neptune, just because of the eternity side of it, and also Venus bringing the peace as well.
Perfect. I thought Ed was nodding
enthusiastically. Great flute part of Neptune. Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. That sort of air of eternity that he writes with, it's incredibly poetic.
And musically, would you stay with Mercury or do you have another favourite?
I wouldn't say with Mercury because it's so hard to conduct, so I'm going to put that to bed. It's funny, the suite sort of, it seems a little divided into movements which are a binary coloured gesture, like Mars is certainly one of those, and the movements which really have the soul. And I would stick with one of those. I mean, Neptune is incredible to finish with, and also Saturn. Saturn is very special to me, actually.
Can you explain to me, Colin, the popularity of the planets? Why is it so popular with listeners? And is it Holst's biggest thing? I mean, I don't want to say one-hit wonder, but is that a thing that some people...
Well, it's not a one-hit wonder. I mean, it's a bit unfair on Holst to call it that. And he was actually himself very disconcerted by the fact that it became the thing he was known by. But, I mean, it's pretty obvious why. I mean, it's an extraordinary piece like no other at the time. You know, seven big movements. And in fact, the original title was Seven Pieces for Large Orchestra. He didn't actually reveal what it was about.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, the planets, it's a strange thing because he would have had a completely different conception of the planets to what we have because we've all seen them all close up. It's astonishing. It is a masterpiece. You know, from start to finish, there isn't a flaw in it, I think.
Mm.
And are there any other works that our listeners should seek out from Holst that you think, if they've listened to The Planets and they're engulfed in it, what would you recommend that they look into?
One really left-field favourite of mine is an overture called Egdon Heath, which is staggering. And it has that same otherworldly spirituality, I think, as some of the movements in this piece. But one piece I discovered recently is Hammersmith, this brass band, a wind band piece, isn't it? And it's extraordinary. It's so jazz inflected. That was something completely new to me. Do you know it, Julia?
I don't, but now that's my listening on the way home.
Those are two that I would have cited as well, but I would add the Hymn of Jesus, which is one of the, I think, very soon after the Planets. And an extraordinary piece, and one of his very last pieces, you know, the lyric movement for viola and small orchestra. And that and Egdon Heath are very characteristic of this sort of very introverted side of Holst.
Oh, yes. I love that. An extra playlist there for our LPR Offstage listeners to delve into. I just want to get a little bit of background of your interaction with the music. Do you remember your first encounter with Holst music, Julia?
I remember playing the Planets at St. Maltings and being completely, I mean, because it's so huge, and just being completely kind of engulfed and overwhelmed by the sound. Yeah, that was my first encounter with it, I think.
And how does he write for your instrument?
Well, I think he writes beautifully for all of the instruments. He actually kind of covers so much. There's four flutes in the Planets. It doubles piccolos and also has got an alto flute in it, and he uses it textually, kind of adding colour chordally, but also, for example, in Mercury, it's very flighty and lots of notey, and sparkly in Jupiter, and then there's some beautifully lyrical solos as well for the instrument. So, yeah, I think it's got everything in it.
He uses the full extent of the instrument to paint those pictures. Colin, do you remember your first encounter?
No, I'm afraid I don't. It would be a long while ago, but it's been part of my life for so long that I can't think back to when I didn't know it.
I think actually a lot of people would give that answer as well. So when was that point where musically, and it transcended listening and it became sort of part of your writing world, if you like?
Well, I suppose I didn't think that much about it. It was just a piece that was there. It wasn't really until I started working with Imogen Holst in the 1970s that I started really thinking about it. And strangely enough, it wasn't her favourite work.
Really?
Partly, I think, influenced by her father's difficulty at being identified with it. Yeah. But also she was particularly fond of the late music, where she thought he'd found his real personality.
Yeah. I'm going to delve into your interaction with Imogen in a moment, but I want to ask you, Ed, having conducted this as well and sort of really got into the nitty-gritty of the Planets, when was your first interaction with it?
Okay, a bit like Colin, I don't know, but it's always been something around. I mean, I'm sure it was done at the Three Choirs Festival in Gloucester when I was a chorister there as a kid. But I remember having, dare I say it, a cassette.
Yes, say it.
of Carrie Anne's version of it. I still remember the picture on that, the big picture of Mars on the front. And I listened to it as a kid. But actually, I came to conducting it very late. I was sort of put off by its ubiquitousness in a way, that it was always around. And I didn't really know the gold underneath the surface of it until I've only really done it for the last 12 years.
It's amazing how that journey happens, isn't it? It's always been around. I think most people would feel that. I'm going to delve into it now with you, Colin. Meeting Imogen Holst for the first time. Tell me a bit more about her interaction with the Planets.
Well, she was a remarkable figure. I met her actually first. It was a private showing of Britain's television opera, Owen Wingrave. And everybody there, including Britain, was all a bit dubious about it. But there was sort of Imogen dancing in the aisles with excitement, which was this sort of side of her personality. She had very much two sides of her personality, a sort of public one, which was very guarded. And you hear her talking in interviews and it's terribly precise and careful. But in private, she completely let her hair down. And I can remember laughing with her as much as anything else.
And tell me about those stories then. When did you start to actually speak about her father? I mean, being a child of somebody so prominent and so famous, did she welcome that kind of conversation?
No, she didn't really. And I mean, Holst remains something of an enigmatic figure to me, because obviously he was a deep thinker, but doesn't give anything away. I mean, if you look at his letters, they're all quite sort of lighthearted and, you know, inconsequential. Yes. And I think I grasped something of what he was like from Imogen's own character, but I still find him, I just don't really understand him. And there's that awful thing is that he was never filmed, he was never recorded speaking. I mean, why didn't they do these things in those days?
Yeah.
I mean, even with Elgar, there's only scraps of him talking, and there's a little bit of moving film, but nothing of Holst. So I've no idea what his voice was like.
It's really interesting, isn't it? And yet we have this music, this legacy that lives on.
Mm.
And so how did the project first start? First of all, could you explain for us what a facsimile is? I've said the word so many times, and I'm thinking of fax, but tell me what a facsimile
well,
is.
Well, it's simple. It's a photograph of the original. The original is in the Bodleian Library in Oxford, and we had access to it. In fact, I went up there to look at it a lot for a collected facsimile edition of Holst's works. But that was the most fascinating one to do because we could go back to the manuscript and check every note and work out what was wrong in the existing scores, which was quite a lot. I mean, because the score, as it is in the manuscript, is not greatly different from the published score, but there are lots of minor details that were wrong and things that were picked up in performance. And we even had, you know, we got advice from Adrian Bolt, who'd conducted the first performance. Right.
So why does it change over time? Is it just how it's been reprinted, redrafted?
Oh, it's any scores like that. It's the whole process of, you know, processing music is so complicated that it's very easy to get things wrong.
And how we write is so, it's so strangely, there are so few options, but it's kind of ambiguous. Even if you look on the facsimile to read certain tiny things, I mean, it's very, you have to be completely forensic and consistent and in a way a composer yourself, like you are, Colin, of course, to be able to understand what the process is. Because we find when we have new editions, they might have everything that's written in the original, but they're not necessarily done by performers for performers. So you end up having to go through the process that early performances of pieces go through. Actually, that's it, isn't it? And there were corrections. You know, I was reading in the appendix about some of the corrections that were made during rehearsals, you know, with the hairpins in the first movement after the facsimile had been made. I mean, these things are organic and they build through the years.
And so tell me a bit about how a score is put together, especially this one. I mean, you're seeing Holst's handwriting. It's chills when you're looking through it, thinking, wow, his actual penmanship is there. But there was a bit of a different journey with this particular...
Well, he had a struggle with his handwriting. He had neuritis in his right arm. Sometimes could hardly hold a pen. And the facsimile is probably well over half in his own hand, but he had a lot of assistance helping him, and I think only Mercury and I think Mars are totally autograph. The others have a lot. Jupiter is almost entirely in his assistant's hands. So what he had done was to prepare a version for two pianos, which his assistants played for him, and they're annotated. But I don't know quite what the process was. He must have sort of stood over them, and you know, you can't...
Yeah.
There isn't enough detail in the piano scores to know exactly how to orchestrate unless he was actually standing there telling them. And it certainly came out the way he wanted.
And Ed, how was it for you first seeing these autographed scores? Having conducted it, you've seen different editions and knowing that this is what the composer wanted.
I'll tell you something, that my initial reaction was negative, and it's very strange because I opened the first page of Mars and you got most of the da-da-da-dum-dum-da-da-da. And for us, that our intensity is 100% when we're playing that. And he just writes bloody repeat signs through the thing, so he doesn't even write it out. But of course he did, because we're used to computerised scores now, so we never really see that anymore. But that immediately made me shut it, and I had to come back to it later, because there's an intensity that we give that isn't necessarily on the page at the moment.
It's full of repeat signs, and that's partly to save himself. He loved being able to write repeat signs.
Yeah.
And whether that actually conditioned the music to a certain extent, I don't know.
I don't. I thought about that as well. I don't think so. No, but just as a performer, to read that sort of lack of complete, you know, you wouldn't see Beethoven doing that as he scrawled all over this Jackson Pollock scores of Beethoven. He would really, he'd work it, and he put every little accent on and every little staccato. But then, as I delved deeper into it, I found some really beautiful things. And as Colin said, the one movement that's all in his own hand is Mercury. And it's like a pointillist painting. It's so beautiful. If people aren't playing, he doesn't put the rest signs in. So they're just empty canvas and these little winds. And you can actually visualise the sound of his orchestration, the delicacy of his orchestration. And that was very special for me.
I really like that perspective, actually, because sometimes, you know, if you get some sheet music, you see a rest, you think, okay, And you almost like your shoulders go down.
So. Yeah, it's true. Yeah. It's
just counting now.
Isn't it?
But yeah, if there's nothing there, it's like, no, be present. Yeah. I just don't want to hear you, but be present.
Yes,
you know,
right,
isn't that
right,
interesting? Yeah. How did you feel looking at these photographs for the first time?
Well, I've only had a very brief look.
Yeah, have a look.
Have a look
while we speak. That's all right. Let me get your honest reaction. Feel free to open the book.
Actually, can I show you Mercury? Because I think you'll love it, because it's so much about what you do too.
Absolutely. I saw a little exchange there. What have you seen in the piccolo part?
Joke,
what have you seen?
Little joke. My first thought was I need to get some glasses because I really am struggling to read a lot of it. So I'm glad that we have some printed parts. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That is absolutely, it's so clear to watch the movement and the flow of it. Because especially in this, because it's so scalic and so flighty.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's all there. It's all there to see and just.
Ed, you've spoken about sort of what you took from it, and obviously everybody would have their personal reaction to what you see on the page. How important do you think it is for conductors, musicians, other composers to go back and look at the original, whether they're noting the mistakes or not? Do you think it's important to just go back and have a look?
Yes, of course. But I mean, some are amazing. Recently we did Mahler 2 and I went through it quite carefully, all the different versions. And there are lots of little additions and stuff cut out that is fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. And in this, one of the other things I got was the things that Holst decided not to do. So in Venus, he had horns for a particular, underweighing a particular texture, but took them out, which I thought was wonderful. Yeah, it scrubs out.
Scrubbed it out.
To make the texture more delicate. And it's really beautiful when you realise what that was. Later on, he cuts a bar because he wanted the pacing to go on more. In Mercury, there was a bit where he had a very low harp underneath an extremely high texture, and he decided to keep it all with helium and trebly. And I think that's the sort of thing which makes me...
Nice.
That's quite inspiring to see that creative process in action, in a way.
Absolutely. I see. So I'm intrigued by the word mistakes. If you could just clarify for me. When you mean mistakes, is that sort of like a dynamic instruction is left out or notes are different? What's the mistake?
It can be dynamics. I mean, because he's sparing with his handwriting, sometimes we added in the addition, we put extra dynamics in square brackets because they're implicit. You know, he's saving himself.
Yeah.
And you need reminders sometimes. You know, if you're playing fortissimo for about two pages, you know, it's useful to have a reminder of that.
There's one lovely little thing in the appendix, I have to say, where Colin says, it's not a staccato over the oboe note, it's an ink blot. So there you go. That's an example of how basic we can sometimes be in our world. Yeah.
I absolutely love that. And actually leads me to the question, Colin, do composers still write by hand?
Less and
What's
less.
What's your feeling about software versus hand?
Well, I've been using the software for almost as long as it's existed, but I still start everything by hand. I sketch by hand. But increasingly, I think composers are just writing straight into the computer, which I find is not helpful in some ways, partly because you can't see a whole page at a time. And secondly, there's nothing like physical contact with the notes. Mm. When you've written out every note by hand, you know it from the inside.
Yeah.
And computerized scores just look too neat too soon.
Nice.
Yeah.
It's like the pen and the paper is the instrument. It's the composer's instrument in a way.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. Are there points, though? I mean, this is the very first, right? This is Holst writing out, working things out. Do you think he wouldn't have wanted us to see this? And are there early sort of autographs that you have that you think, I don't really need them to see this?
Yeah, I think I'd feel that about myself to a certain extent. And I'm very chaotic at how I keep everything, but in total chaos. Nobody would ever be able to sort it out. I don't think Holst would have minded. I mean, he kept the manuscript himself. And I think manuscripts are very important to composers.
And Juliet, for you, seeing how it's written, and obviously you'll have some more time with that original copy as well, will it inform how you approach your performance that's coming up in April? Will it inform how you play it, or do you think it's just
Well, we don't often get to see the scores, and we certainly don't often get to see the facsimile scores. So, as you know, performance, we often just come into work and the parts are there very nicely in our folders by the librarians, kindly. And so, yes, I mean, obviously, it would very much influence the way I would then approach playing the piece of music if I can see the, particularly the original facsimile score. But yeah, when it comes to it, I know that I'll probably just have my part and then
play it.
Play for my part, yeah.
Colin, it's wonderful to have you here with us. We know the planets. There's an extra planet. Because, of course, Holst wrote for 7 planets, but there was one that wasn't discovered at the time. And Colin, Pluto the Renewer, how did you get to thinking, there's something missing or there's something I want to add? Is it even an extension? What is it?
I knew this was coming
up. I know.
It's actually quite a complicated question because I was very reluctant to do it. And if Kent Nagano hadn't twisted my arm, I mean, it was actually something that you said earlier about it, you know, being so familiar. Mm. And Kent said, you know, I want something new when I'm doing it. He actually asked me if I could write Earth as well to begin it, which I did draw the line at. But I eventually sort of gave in, partly because I knew if I said no, he'd just go and ask somebody else. And I thought, well, perhaps I have a responsibility to do this. And it was a strange experience because I couldn't think of any way it could begin other than underneath the end of Neptune, because you couldn't stop after Neptune. So it has to continue. And in fact, Pluto ends with the same chorus chord that Neptune does, as though it was always there in the background.
Yeah.
It was quite a scary experience because when it was announced, it was on the front page of the newspapers and I got rung up by the Today programme and I thought, oh my God, I'm assaulting a sacred cow. When actually it came to the first performance, you know, I was just sort of a bit worried about being booed off the stage.
Yeah, yeah.
But in fact, it was received so well that Kent did it a second time. And then when Mark Elder took over the Hallé, it was, I think, the first recording that was made. So that was, it became special. And it had, I mean, it had well over 100 performances up to the point when Pluto was demoted.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Since when it's tended to have disappeared from the scene. But, you know, that's something I was when Pluto was demoted, I was immediately rung up all over the place saying, you know, what does this mean to you? And I said, well, I always knew it wasn't really a planet. And I said so in my first programme note.
What do you think that Holst and Imogen Holst would have thought of the piece?
Holst would have been very confused by it, I think, the thought of it, because, I mean, I'm sure people would, because it was discovered 4 years before he died, and I'm sure people would have said, aren't you going to write Pluto? And
yeah, true.
He wouldn't have, the last thing in the world he would do. I think Imogen would have been slightly dismayed, but she would also have been very amused by it, I think.
That's lovely. Oh, thank you so much. I know you were probably expecting that question to come. You answered that so gracefully and really insightful, actually. Let's talk about Jupiter for a moment. How did it come to sort of have a new life and be sort of synonymous with a hymn?
Yes, I do know. It's a bit like Land of Hope and Glory. Somebody asked Elgar to set those words and he couldn't think of anything. He said, oh, try and fix it to the pomp and circumstance.
I don't know this, actually. The same was with Holst.
And Holst. He was asked to. He was far too busy to actually set it and said, well, Jupiter would fit the words. And so it became, you know, synonymous with that. But it's a pity that it affects too many performances.
So
because
true.
Yes.
So true.
If you listen to Holst's own performances, he actually marks it in the score at exactly half the speed of the main tempo, which is pretty fast anyway, but actually in his recording, he does it faster than that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for him, I mean, you know, Jupiter is the bringer of jollity. You don't want to suddenly get all solemn and stand up and be patriotic.
And actually, that's a lovely little addition. You can see that really clearly in the facsimile. It's really added to what it is. And Dante Maestoso, I think. And then, just to be clear, don't you mess around with my tempo. It's written as an addition. And I'm really strong on that as well. As Colin says, it's not some big self-immolating hymn at all. And it's really important it's not.
Thank you.
And Ed, what are the particular joys and challenges of conducting this work?
Okay, I'll give you the career-ending one. It seems we're in a private conversation.
Well, we're in a safe place.
Mars is in five, and you get so used to conducting in five, you think you're conducting in four. So you have to really keep your together in order not to do it. That's the end of my relationship with the LPO. It's the variety of it is extraordinary. I mean, I would say Mercury is unbelievable and hard. And it's written, some of the string passage work is written with the change of chords against the beat. So it sounds like it's wrong even when it's right. It's extraordinarily complex writing. That movement is difficult. But this, I mean, the LPO, they'll play this incredibly well. I find some of the bigger textures hard to make sound really beautiful. I mean, actually, even the beginning of Jupiter is difficult to get this feeling that's not heavy and just sort of weighted down. Uranus is the toughest one for that. Lots of low brass, lots of organ pedals, and it should feel like Harry Potter on a large scale. And it's very, very difficult. But these are all challenges that are lovely to have, actually.
I'd say in Uranus in particular, you've got to keep that sense of humour alive.
Yes, exactly.
It can't ever be too heavy.
No, and it's written, the orchestra, we should say the orchestra is enormous for this piece. And it's when it's used with, you know, the flute choir together or the clarinet choir, with the bass clarinet, it feels like rich, small groups, but it's very big when you've got everyone together. That feeling of lightness.
Thank you for being so candid. That's really helpful. What about the fact that he wrote different key signatures and different sections playing at the same time? So several keys playing at once. I mean, for a player, you're reading, so that's great, but I mean, does your ear ever sort of lead you to think, am I even doing this right?
Well, it is complex in parts, but I think, you know, you just get very used to your part and kind of orally what's going on at the time. And that's how we'll learn and play everything. We're reacting to what's going on in the orchestra and to other players. As you were just saying, Ed, that, like, you know, because it's so thick and it's so, at the same time, so contrasting, I think as far as performance for us, it's really going to extremes with the dynamics. I mean, like the huge dynamic range used throughout, but also the articulation of the really, really sonorous long phrasing, and then obviously kind of straight contrasting lightness as well, to create the kind of cosmic glitter, as it were, sparkle. And so, you know, that's, as a performer, that's what's on us as well. I mean, obviously, then we've got the maestro who's going to be kind of balancing it all. Keeping the tempo going. But you know, as a performer, that's kind of what I'd be concentrating on, is making sure that when I'm performing it and playing it, I'm really the details in that and going to extremes as I can.
You've got a performance coming up we're in March now as we're recording, but in April, so it's not long to go. How are you preparing the ladies' choir, Ed, especially for Neptune? Is it easy to do that sort of fade out in the Royal Festival Hall?
It's not easy, but we've got quite a lot of experience of it, and it's one of our wonderful stage managers closes a door slowly. I shouldn't let the magic into the... I shouldn't tell you the trick.
But it's like,
and I sit there, I stand there with the orchestra on stage playing beautifully at the end and going, more door, less door, until it's... Yeah, it's true.
The door is an essential part. On performance night, you can see said door. Can you see the door?
Yeah, I can see it. Yeah.
And you conduct the door?
Or we have a sort of number that we do it. And there are various ways. Actually, in all seriousness, there are ways you can have of having this incredible... I mean, you really want a CD fade out, don't you? That's what... And there are ways you do it. I mean, they can hold their hands over them as they turn around sometimes for the last couple of phrases, or even start humming. You know, it's really... There are ways of... But it's... I mean, it's hard, that effect, and it takes a little bit of time. I'm warning Juliet now. It takes a little bit of time.
Bear with me.
Yes, and the notes aren't easy either.
No, it's true. No.
Amazing. Well, I have to wrap up, but my final question to help the LPO listeners as they now go back and sort of digest all that they've heard here and either re-listen or explore the planets for the first time. If you are going to listen to the planets, do you start at the beginning? Is it a journey or is there a planet that the listeners should start with? A little bit of advice, Colin.
That's a really good question.
It's a good question. And I'd really have to think about which one I would direct an individual to. And yes, I mean, it's a 40, 50 minute listen. Mm-hmm. So no easy task for a listener.
But you wouldn't say to start at the start, would you?
I think I'd probably throw Mercury at them first.
Mm. Mercury, like that. Juliet?
I don't know. I think I probably would go out as a whole and to get the experience of, because, you know, starting with Mars, it's so impactful, you know, and I think it kind of grabs you straight away. And I think, yes, there is a huge contrast between all the movements, but just taking you through space.
Through space. I like that. Ed?
Well, my experience of what I would do is very different from encouraging people to listen to the piece. I mean, the impact, as Juliet says, the impact of Mars is enormous. But if I was going to just sum it up a piece of music in my head, it would be those first bars of Venus are happening after Mars. I mean, that's really something extraordinary, the difference in the contrast. Or like Colin says, Mercury. I mean, it's the slighter movements which really, really appeal to me. The smaller, after he's done this, something so enormous that he can take it down to really nothing.
Yeah. This is what I love about this podcast. Everybody listens and takes it in a different way. It's fantastic advice. And thank you all so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, that's all we've got time for today on LPO Offstage with me, Yolanda Brown. Thanks so much to Colin, Ed and Juliet for joining me today to explore the planets. And if you'd like to send in any questions to be featured in this current series, please email offstage@lpo.org.uk. Whether you'd like to pick up some practice tips, get to know the musicians in the LPO or learn more about orchestral repertoire, that's offstage@lpo.org.uk. Or you can message us on social media @London Philharmonic Orchestra. I'll see you next time.